Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. It is Friday, October 15th, and I'm your co-host, Joanne Chang. I'm joined in the studio by Allison Cole, my
Hello.
Co-host. Hi. And Carissa Thorpe, as well as Maniac Dan, who is supervising the controls today because Allison Cole is doing the controls.
Happy Friday.
Woohoo! Yes. Today on the show, we'll be interviewing Ellie Hafiz, an art director in an LA advertising firm who started a blog called I Quit Eating Meat, documenting his journey from meat eater to vegan. His transformation happened shortly after he heard a radio interview with Jonathan Safran Foer, the author of the best-selling nonfiction book Eating Animals. And appropriately for our feature interview, we will be playing an interview which Allison and I have pre-recorded with Jonathan Safran Foer about a week and a half ago when he was in Canada. So, ladies, did you guys have a nice cruelty-free Thanksgiving?
I always have a cruelty-free Thanksgiving if I celebrate it or not, which yeah. I did not this year.
You didn't celebrate it this year?
Well, no, I didn't do anything, but I wasn't. I haven't had much of an appetite anyways, being all sick last week,
right.
So I probably wouldn't have eaten anything anyways.
Right, you got me sick, yeah. And I was...
I got you sick.
You did.
Oh, great. Thanks.
And I was, like, cooking for 15 hours my un-turkey roast the whole time, sneezing in the pot.
Oh, sorry.
And now I got my husband sick, too.
Oh.
That was a bonus, right?
That was a bonus. That's right. Be careful, Carissa, or you're going to be next.
I should move over.
Did you have a good tofurkey?
I didn't actually have a tofurkey. I just
you
had
didn't.
Some stuffing.
Oh, you guys should have come over to my house. Awesome. So I think you have the news for us this week.
Yes, I do. There's another reason why McDonald's Happy Meals are anything but. Well, we know that none of the meals come with happy endings for the factory-farmed animals whose flesh serve as the basis for the meals. News has been spreading this week of New York-based artist Davies' latest work. For the past 6 months, Davies has left a Happy Meal consisting of a burger and fries sitting out in the open and documenting its progress with a daily photo posted on her Flickr account, or rather, its lack of progress. The so-called meal has yet to grow mold, and according to the UK Daily Mail, Davies said, "The only change that I can see is that it has become hard as a rock and that the food is plastic to the touch and has an acrylic sheen to it." The project started as a way to prove a skeptical friend wrong, as he thought she was gullible for believing that a nutritionist named Karen Hanher had kept a similar meal for over 12 years to use as an educational tool for parents. McDonald's spokesperson Teresa Riley released a statement saying Davies' work is unsubstantiated and something out of the realm of urban legends. Is it any wonder that even Davies' dogs lost interest in the burger and fries the second day, which was also when the meal reportedly lost its smell? Although Davies herself is a vegan, she did say, "I would be frightened at seeing this if I was a meat eater," asking why not even the bun has started molding. Yet another reason to try veganism on for size.
You know what? There's a guy, he has a website called thebionicburger.com, I believe. And he started it because he had a McDonald's burger that he put in his jacket pocket. And, you know, in the winter, you just, you know, like it was during probably season change. So then he puts his jacket in the closet with the burger in there. A year later, he took out the burger and it looked exactly the same.
Yeah.
So then he has this experiment where he has like burgers from 2 years ago, 3 years ago, all McDonald's burgers, and they all look just exactly the same. No mold on them or anything.
The really interesting thing was the McDonald's rep also said that they source their ingredients locally. As part of their statement.
From the local chemists and factory farms.
Yeah. And in sadder news, on Monday, October 4th, another orca's life was tragically cut short at SeaWorld Orlando, the third so far this year alone at the theme park. This orca's name was Kalina, and she was the first orca bred in captivity to make it to adulthood as part of SeaWorld's breeding program. Mm. The sad reality is that she lived all of her days in a barren concrete pool surrounded by only gallons of water rather than the immeasurable vastness of the ocean that should have been her birthright. Kalina lived... a life marked by many unnatural occurrences. She was first impregnated at the age of only 6 when she was still only a juvenile, as whale births before the age of 12 are extremely rare in the wild, and she became the first grandmother in captivity. She birthed 4 calves in her lifetime and undoubtedly suffered when they were taken from her, since orcas by nature remain with their families for life. And she was moved from Florida to Ohio to California to Texas, then finally back to Florida, sharing her tank with at least 30 others in her lifetime. According to SeaWorld officials, Kalina showed no signs of illness leading up to her death, but began showing signs of discomfort in the afternoon before dying suddenly in the early evening. A necropsy will be performed, but could take up to 6 weeks for results. Kalina died at the age of 25, despite the average life expectancy for whales being 50 to 60 years in the wild.
Oh my God, that is so sad.
Yeah.
You know, who we had, Rick O'Berry, on the show a few months ago, and he talks about something like this happening in aquariums all the time, because whales and dolphins, they have to come up to the surface to breathe,
mm-hmm.
and they can choose not to take that next breath, and commit suicide. And that happens a lot to dolphins and whales in captivity because they can't take it anymore.
Yeah, can you imagine? I can't imagine even having 30 roommates, life, let alone having 30 tank mates in a tank where you don't belong, right?
A tank is nothing comparable to the ocean, and it never will be, no matter what people say. It never will be.
Yeah, and yeah, just think about it. 30 roommates, and you can't escape that.
Yeah.
I would kill myself.
And just being moved around so much as well, like crazy.
Great. Thanks for that. Is that the news?
Yep.
Just want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, and we are a publicly supported radio station. And at this time, during our fall fun drive, we'd like you to log on to cooperadio.org. And if you think this program is valuable, please make a donation. And every donation you make, make sure you you tag it for Animal Voices, because that's how we're kept on the show. Kept on the air, and we really appreciate every single dollar that you contribute to keep us on the air. So that again is cooperadio.org. Okay, right now we have on the line our very first interview today. So joining us now is Ali Hafiz, a martial artist and art director of an advertising agency in Los Angeles, where he lives with his 6-year-old rescue dog, Lark. In his spare time, Ali maintains a blog called I Quit Eating Meat. You can check him out on iquiteatingmeat.blogspot.com. The blog was something that he started a year ago, shortly after hearing an interview on the radio with Jonathan Safran Foer, and I am a huge fan of this blog because it documents from day one Ali's transformation from meat eater to vegan. Welcome to Animal Voices, Ali.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm so excited to have you on the show because I've been reading your journey right from the beginning, and it's such an inspiration how you just dove into it and made going vegan look so simple. Have you had people telling you that you've been an inspiration for their own transformation?
You know, when I started the blog, I really thought, you know, nobody was going to read it except maybe my mom, you know. But surprisingly, yes, you know, there's a woman I work with who, through the blog, decided that she wanted to go vegan.
Wow.
I've had a couple of friends who've really thought about it hard and maybe haven't gone vegan, but researched meat and are eating meat a lot less than they used to. And in my family, the same thing's been happening. So, yeah, it's really been unexpected, but really great.
That's very powerful. And a year ago, you heard Jonathan Safran Foer on the radio talking about his new book, Eating Animals, and ultimately that prompted you to go vegan. Now, were you already thinking about going vegan at that point, or did this just come out of the left field for you?
It came out of left field. I've had my sister and her husband have been vegan for years, and it never crossed my mind to do it. I just, you know, I was so ingrained in that mindset of that I just had to eat meat and there was no choice. But when I, just the way he articulated it, you know, it was in the morning, I was getting ready to go to work, and I heard that interview, and I just said to myself, you know what? I'm done. I can't do it anymore.
Wow.
After hearing him explain it so simply.
And I heard that interview. It wasn't really anything compared to what's in the book.
Right, right.
Did you actually read Eating Animals before you started on this venture?
Well, after hearing the interview, I already decided to stop eating meat, mm-hmm. but I hadn't decided to go vegan, and then I bought the book, and after I got halfway through the book, I was talking to my brother-in-law, and he's like, well, if you're doing it for ethical reasons, you really can't eat dairy either, and I was like, you're right, and so here we go, going all the way.
Yeah, so, you know, what I love about reading your blog is that you started it as soon as you decided to go, to give up meat. So we actually see your life transform as you go from omnivore to vegan. Can you tell us what made you decide to document this journey from the very beginning?
It was to have a sense of accountability. You know, if I'm putting it out there and I know I'm going to be honest on the blog, that it'll be a motivation for myself if other people are reading it, give mm-hmm. me, you know, some sort of responsibility. And the other reason was that just knowing myself and knowing that I thought I could never do anything like this and that it would be so difficult, that if there was anybody else out there in my situation, know somebody who's athletic, kind of younger, and doesn't really think that this is a viable option, that if they looked at my journey, they could see, like, oh, well, this guy did it. You know, it wasn't necessarily easy, and he had some bumps in the road, but mm-hmm. it could maybe serve as an inspiration or an example to somebody who maybe thought they couldn't do it, you know?
Right. But you didn't really know what you were doing either, did you? Like, you were just figuring it out as you were going along.
Pretty much. I mean, I did, like you said, I wanted to stop so quickly. I mean, yeah. I literally gave all my food to my neighbor that had meat in it and, you know, emptied my fridge and just started looking on the internet for, you know, vegan recipes and went to PETA and downloaded their, you know, starter kit for becoming a vegetarian, and just sort of my main goal was, okay, if I'm not eating meat, from what I'm reading, I just have to eat as many different things as possible. And I just went to the store and I bought all kinds of different nuts and seeds and lentils and kale and vegetables I'd never eaten before, and
right.
went for it.
How long has it been since you started?
It's been almost a year. I believe it was mm-hmm. November of last year.
And how have you been finding it? Because it looks like you really went into it full force. A lot of people might, when they go vegan or vegetarian at first, they might not do it right. You actually went out and bought the vegetables you had never heard of or tasted before, and the grains, and it sounds like you've been doing a lot of cooking, and that's what good, you know, plant-based food is. Mm. So for you, how has it been? Like, are you eating better? Do you enjoy your food?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I can't believe... I used to eat, you know, quote unquote healthy, and to me that was, you know, steamed vegetables and chicken every single day. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize what I was missing out on. I mean, I eat such a range of foods now. My energy level was higher almost immediately just because my body wasn't having to process all this heavy meat all the time. And overall, I'd say I feel a lot better. I'm definitely enjoying the food. I'm enjoying exploring and cooking and making my smoothies every morning. But there are those times here and there where I'll be stressed or I'll have a craving or something mm-hmm. and I'll want a comfort food, and those things that I ate for years and years and years will come to my mind as something that I want. But
right.
Overall, I'm very happy. You know, I don't really miss meat.
Well, you know, I was so inspired by your blog because I've been a vegan for a very long time. And for me, going vegetarian, going vegan, giving up those things took years. And you pretty much just dove into it. I think in your blog, the last thing you ate, like in your first entry, was a Wendy's burger, was it?
Is that, you know, I don't remember, but that's definitely possible.
Yeah, and then you pretty much just went from that and into being vegan.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Okay, well, you said that you were going to gradually give up animal products and then maybe going the vegan route. Can you tell us how long exactly it took you to go from meat eating to vegan?
Well, I gave myself, when I started the blog, I gave myself a week from hearing the interview to stop eating meat.
Yeah.
And I ended up not even eating it in the last few days because I just said, you know, I've made this decision for so many reasons. Why am I just going to eat meat up until the last minute? You know, that doesn't really make any sense. So... and then within that week, I had started eating animals, and so I would say from meat eating to deciding to go vegan was maybe 2-3 weeks at the most.
Wow.
Which is...
Before you even finished reading the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. Now, can you tell us some of the foods that you enjoy now that you've never eaten before becoming a vegan?
Sure. One of my things that I enjoy the most is I make a green smoothie every day.
And yay! I've been doing that too. They're wonderful. Kale.
Yep, kale. I've been starting lately to use collard greens or mustard greens and spinach in there also. Mm. And I couldn't have even pointed to collard greens or kale in the grocery store before. I mean, I didn't even know that they had them. You know what I mean? I wouldn't have been able to find them. But, you know, now I'm eating them raw daily, and I'm buying bunches of them every week. So,
do you find that your palate has changed since you've been discovering all these plant-based foods, that your palate is just more open to these different tastes and textures that you hadn't tried before?
Definitely. Yeah, I don't know if it's a biological thing that my body is saying, you know, making things seem more appetizing because I need the nutrients, or if it's just partly a mental thing because I know that I need to eat this variety of foods to stay healthy, so I'm just willing to try anything. But either way, the result's the same, that if I'm at a restaurant or the store, or, you know, of course there's those couple things that, you know, for whatever reason I just can't get into Brussels sprouts, and I haven't
Don't tried worry, those that's not unusual.
But overall, yeah, I'm just willing to try anything because at the very least I know that it's giving me the variety of nutrients that I need to stay healthy.
I'm curious if you were addicted to any meat or dairy foods before, like cheese, for example, which is really hard to get off. Were you a big cheese eater?
Oh, yes. I was a huge cheese
eater. And then you just stopped eating immediately.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
It was definitely hard. I mean, luckily living in LA, there's a lot of vegan restaurants and grocery stores that carry vegan food. So, you know, right away I was able to go to Whole Foods and get, you know, a vegan pizza if I wanted, or get diet cheese to make quesadillas with at home. So I had the substitutes, and at first they weren't all that satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
But especially in the beginning, I was just so laser focused on not wanting it anymore that really carried me through, you know, kind of like quitting smoking. It's really hard to quit smoking if you don't really want to, you know, but I know, like, when I quit smoking, I was just so disgusted with it that I just wasn't going to put that in my mouth, you know. So that definitely helps.
And what were some of the positive things that you've discovered after going vegan?
Like I mentioned before, my energy level, you know, just feeling lighter That was a huge plus for me. I kind of felt like a weight was off my chest, that I was enlightened to a certain degree, you know, that I had been living in denial for so long, you know, knowing that factory farming was horrible, but somehow putting it in the back of my mind to finally bring that to the forefront and address it just kind of felt like a weight off my shoulders, that I was living more in line with my values.
Mm-hmm. And your blood pressure went down, didn't it?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That was completely unexpected, right?
Right. And I, you know, I'm lucky. I have a high metabolism. I've never really had a problem with weight, even though I was eating Wendy's burgers, like you said. But I did lose almost 10 pounds that I think was just, you know, inevitable of just whatever gunk was built up from all that meat I was eating. And it's inspired a lot of conversation with like-minded people, you know, people I was working with. I was like, oh, I didn't know you were a vegan or vegetarian. And
right.
I go to farmers markets more, and it just opened up a whole, you know,
world. LA has some really great farmers markets. Which ones do you go to? I'm curious.
There's one that I really like in Hollywood on Cahuenga, the Hollywood Farmers Market, and that one's
I
huge.
Drove past that one last month, and I wanted to go to it. I haven't been to that one. But
yeah, it's crazy.
You're so
it's
lucky
like
that you have, yeah,
blocks.
Being in California, you've got all the great fresh foods there that don't have to be imported like we have here.
And, you know, you're an athlete too, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Has being vegan negatively impacted your health in any way or your athletic abilities?
You know, that was one of the things I was really concerned about, you know, getting enough protein or being too fatigued. And honestly, you know, the opposite happened. I would get in the gym and I'd be training and I'd have more energy. And that really amazed me because that wasn't something I was willing to sacrifice,
right.
You know, and so I was really afraid. I was like, what's going to happen if I don't have enough energy or I'm not feeling strong? I'm going to have to figure something out. But luckily, that didn't happen, and my energy level was higher, and I felt great in there. So
yeah, and you're in good company because Bob Harper, the badass fitness trainer on The Biggest Loser, is vegan as well.
Oh, really?
And he sure has got lots of energy.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I researched, too, when I first started. All the athletes that are vegan, you know, there's a few famous ones like Carl Lewis, and I follow MMA. There's a couple UFC fighters that are vegan that you would never know by looking at them. So
right.
I figure, hey, these top-level athletes are doing it. Brendan Brazier, I think you've had him on or mentioned him before, the triathlete. So,
yeah, so that's excellent. Do you have any advice you would give to someone who wants to jump into this lifestyle like you did?
Well, you know, everybody's different. I think when I talk to people about the way I did it, they tend to think it's a little extreme, and that's kind of the way I do things. But I just tell people, because a lot of my friends, even if they're on board, they think it's daunting. And I just say, hey, you don't, it's not a one or the other type of thing. You know, why don't you try just being vegetarian or vegan a couple days a week, you know, see how you feel. Or try it for a month. You know, there seems to be this mindset that I either have to be one or the other. But
right.
I think if somebody's thinking about it, you know, just do it. Don't put so much pressure on yourself that it's gonna have to go one way or the other. Just
right. Now, I know that you ran into a bit of a setback lately. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I had a ruptured disc in my spine that was really painful and debilitating. And I was having a lot of trouble, you know, mentally and physically. I was having a hard time, you know, just moving around. And I'm so used to being athletic. And so I wasn't burning calories. I wasn't feeling hungry. And I had to have surgery. And I started to get scared that I wasn't getting enough nutrients in my body. And I was still new to being vegan, and I didn't want to risk, you know, my future health or my current health, and I was just happy to want to eat something. So I did eat meat and dairy during that time in the month before my surgery. I mean, it wasn't like every single day, you know, but a couple times a week when I just felt like I was craving it, because I think my body did need those proteins, because I just wasn't able to eat the volume or the range of foods that I should have been on a plant-based diet. And even post-surgery, I still have another month to go till I'm healed, and I've had meat maybe once a week or every couple weeks to just make sure I'm getting enough. But at home, I'm 100% vegan. I'd say I'm 99% back to being vegan. But I just had this kind of mental, physical hump that I had to get over, and I just wasn't prepared enough in that state to stick with it.
And, you know, as a reader of your blog, I really appreciate you being so honest about things like that, because, you know, certainly it's really difficult to do that so publicly. And are you thinking of going back to being vegan after you're completely healed?
Definitely. I mean, it's honestly just a physical thing. I just want to be sure that my body's getting everything it needs to heal 100% because I am so active and it's so important to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no desire to be an omnivore.
Excellent. Well, it's been really great chatting with you. We're all out of time now.
Well, it's been really great talking to you, and I'm very flattered that you guys enjoy my blog. And
yeah, thanks for coming on the show.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Take care.
You too.
That was Ali Hafiz of I Quit Eating Meat. To check out his blog, go to iquiteatingmeatblogspot.com.
You're listening to the Animal Voices Show on 102.7 FM CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and I have the events for you right now. On Thursday, October the 21st at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern and Pacific Standard Time, there's a really interesting-looking television documentary being played on the nature of things with David Suzuki. It's called For the Love of Elephants. It's on the CBC Newswork. Have either of you seen it? It aired this week.
No.
So it might be... Actually, it's probably new, but it just aired this week, and now it's airing again. It looks really interesting. So For the Love of Elephants is an intimate portrait of an amazing elephant-human bond that develops at an elephant rehabilitation center near Nairobi, Kenya. The film takes viewers inside the emotional world of young orphaned African elephants and their compassionate keepers, Edwin, Meshach, and Abdi. Never far from their charge are the center's founder, Dame Daphne Sheldrick, and their daughter, Angela, who manages the Sheldrick Trust. Through hard work, love, and dedication, the expert team create a unique human-elephant family and nurture the orphaned elephants back to health. This looks like a super interesting show, and I watched the video promo for it online. And if you're not in Canada and you don't get this channel, I think you might be able to watch it later online, as I see that all of the past Nature of Things shows are posted at cbc.ca/video. So do check it out. I know that I'm going to. On Saturday, October the 23rd, from 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., EarthSafe Canada presents its 12th annual Taste of Health Vegetarian Food Festival.
I'm going.
Yeah. Are you going, Carissa? It's a must-go to if you haven't before.
I want to go really badly, but I'm supposed to work, and they're not letting me out of it.
I took the day off work just for this.
I've been the past 3 years, I think.
Yeah, I've been committed now since 2003.
So that happens. Committed since 2003.
Yeah, that's my slogan. It's at the Vancouver Masonic Center this year at 1495 West 8th Avenue in Vancouver. So come and discover the environmental health and ethical benefits of a plant-based diet during this one-day special event. There will be workshops, presentations, and raw food demos at this year's Taste of Health, as well as lots of free food sampling that is all plant-based food. It's always a fun festival to go to, and the price is right at only $5 for the general public. Woo-hoo. And free for children and Earth Save members. To find out more about the event and to see a full schedule for the day, please visit tasteofhealth.earthsave.ca. And also on Saturday, October the 23rd, from 1 to 4 p.m., there will be a presentation called Howls and Growls, Creatures of the Great Bear Rainforest. This is at the Lynn Canyon Ecology Center at 3663 Park Road. That's in North Vancouver. And you can come and meet award-winning wildlife photographer and filmmaker Ian McAllister, who will be sharing stories, photos, and videos of his animal friends in the Great Bear Rainforest.
He takes amazing photos.
Yeah, so it's happening that day and also happening in Victoria the next day at the Maritime Museum of British Columbia. Also later that evening on Saturday, October the 23rd, from at 6 o'clock p.m., Earth Save Canada will be presenting a fundraising gala featuring keynote speaker John Robbins, also at the Vancouver Masonic Center at 1495 West 8th Avenue in Vancouver. John Robbins is, of course, the founder of Earth Save and the author of the best-selling book Diet for a New America, among other books, which was the impetus for the creation of Earth Save International, a nonprofit organization which strives to educate the public on the ethical, health, and environmental consequences of our food choices and encourages the shift towards a plant-based diet. Tickets for this event are available right now for $25 for the early bird price. I think it's going to be $35 closer to the date. And this includes appetizers catered by the raw food restaurant Organic Lives, a beverage, music, a silent auction, a keynote address from John Robbins, and a chance to mingle and other entertainment. So if you want to buy a ticket, call 604-731-5885. If you have an animal or vegetarian related event coming up that you would like to have announced on the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, which is called Animal Voices Vancouver.
Thank you for that, Allison. And I just want to remind our listener, you're listening to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. Please remember to support us by going to cooperadio.org and make a pledge to keep us on the air. Coming up next is Jonathan Safran Foer, who we've done a recorded interview with. Jonathan Safran Foer is the author of the best-selling nonfiction book Eating Animals, which created a lot of discussion in mainstream media about the ethics of eating meat when it came out a year ago. And surprisingly enough, the discussion has not died down yet a year later. Just a week ago, Jonathan Safran Foer created another buzz when he was on CBC debating with Anthony Bourdain on the topic, Should We Eat Meat? And as you've heard earlier, Jonathan Safran Foer's book has created profound changes in people like our previous guest. Prior to writing Eating Animals, Jonathan Safran Foer was already acclaimed fiction writer, highly regarded in the literary world. His first book, Everything is Illuminated, won him the National Jewish Book Award and a Guardian First Book Award. His second book, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, was made into a full-length feature film. We're extremely excited to have caught up with him a couple of weeks ago and recorded an interview, which we will play for you in a couple of seconds. But I just wanted to warn our listeners, the interview actually cuts off in the middle because we were actually cut off on the phone. And when I phoned him back to finish the interview, I had forgotten to turn on the record button.
Oh, boy.
We missed the best part. Yeah. And we'll discuss that after this. So here we go. Welcome to Animal Voices, Jonathan.
Hi.
Before writing Eating Animals, you were a fiction writer. What motivated you to write an entirely nonfiction book about animal agriculture?
A couple things, Dan. Firstly, it's a subject I've been interested in for almost my whole life. And then that interest took on an urgency when my wife became pregnant and I faced the prospect of having to feed a child. And that suddenly reframed the whole question, and I didn't feel comfortable any longer just relying on my instincts or the limited knowledge that I have. I really wanted to make informed decisions. Secondly, you know, writers are often attracted to silences, and there is a very strange and profound silence surrounding meat.
it is something that is at the center of so many people's lives, and it's almost never at the center of our minds or our conversations. I guess I was attracted to that silence. You know, it's not that I care more about animal agriculture than I do about starving kids or AIDS or genocide. But those are subjects that have, you know, entered the public consciousness in very powerful ways, and this hasn't. And I want it to be part of the expansion of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you try to get into factory farms to do research for your book. What was the response from the owners of the farms when you requested to visit?
Well, there was exactly no response. You know, I never got letters back to my letters. My phone calls were met with different kinds of evasion or just silence. And I found it both very surprising and weird. You know, like, it's hard to imagine any industry in the United States, with the possible exception of the military, that would be so resistant to sharing information. But I also found it infuriating. You know, this is a food that we're expected to eat and give to our kids, and yet we're not trusted with the most basic information of how it's made.
And why do you think they don't want you on the farm?
I mean, it's obvious. I don't even think it's an opinion. I think it's practically a fact. They don't want people there because they know that the more we learn about these farms, the more we learn about the process that brings meat to our plates, the less inclined we are going to be to eat it.
Mm-hmm. And what was the most shocking thing you found doing research for this book?
I think the most shocking thing was how systematized this is. You know, the animal cruelty, it's not really right to call it an accident when it's happening at all of these farms. And the environmental destruction can't really be called an accident when some of these companies have, for example, 7,000 violations of the Clean Water Act in 1 year.
Hmm.
You know, it starts to look like this is what we have in mind. And the fact that we're factory farming 50 billion animals every year, that it totally dominates America and Europe, is very actively spreading across India and China, is just terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think most people think in those terms, like 55 billion animals and there's only, you know, 7 billion humans, so they really outnumber us by a lot.
Well, the number I gave doesn't include fish also,
right,
which would send it into the, you know, stratosphere.
Right. And why do you think there's such a disconnect between the food we eat and our own moral values?
I think there are a number of explanations. One is just information. You know, it's a very secretive industry, and a very deceptive industry as well, that, you know, presents us with images and stories about our food that just aren't plainly wrong, you know, or lies, you could say. Another reason is it is difficult to face something that's painful, especially when it's so fundamental to our lives, our families, our culture. So, you know, it's not surprising that we would find ways of avoiding this topic.
So obviously the topic of meat is a sensitive subject, as you've said, especially with all of our cultural traditions and that. And what do we need to do to just get it out there and to make it something that people are willing to openly discuss and think about? And what do we have to do, do you think, just to make it a normal conversation?
Well, I think what you just said is right. We have to make it a normal conversation. We have to take it out of the realm of philosophy, out of the realm of expose journalism, out of the realm of argument, and instead, you know, present it with humility, with openness, with an understanding that, you know, we're all hypocrites. It's not like anybody is getting this perfectly right. So, you know, instead of saying, oh, but you eat this, or oh, but you wear a leather belt, or oh, but you walk on the grass and inevitably squash insects, you know, we should instead be saying, how can we limit our meat consumption? And, you know, that's honestly how I think about it. I eat as little meat as possible. For me, it's zero. But if someone says to me, I read your book and I was really moved, and now I don't eat meat at lunch, I think that's an amazing thing. Mm-hmm. The less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
I think if someone says they're just eating meat only for lunch, then at least that means that they've thought about it and they're making a conscious decision. I think that's what's important as well.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So do you think we're at a point where our food choices should be perhaps more political than just something that we do to satisfy our taste buds?
Yes, clearly. But the best way to bring that about is not necessarily to politicize it, as strange as that might sound. That can really turn people off. You know, I think what you said about making it a conversation and just trying to expand the conversation and make that conversation more mainstream is to me, it seems like the right technique, or at least another good technique. PETA, groups like PETA, really actively politicize it. Mm-hmm. And they've been hugely successful. I mean, they might be the most successful activist group of any kind. But there is a limit to what they can do. And I think we need other voices.
Now, October is the month when Canadians celebrate Thanksgiving. Can you tell us something about modern turkey farming that most people may not know about?
Turkey farming is just one of the worst kinds of farming. The turkeys that we buy in supermarkets, not most, but more than 99% of them are incapable of reproducing sexually. You know, this is an animal that we're putting at the center of a table when we're supposed to be celebrating bounty and harvest. There's something truly insane about that. It's an animal that is almost always given antibiotics from birth until death, almost always bred to grow incredibly quickly on very little food, so that if it were allowed to live out of its adolescence, its bones would start to break under the weight of its body and its tendons would start to slip. It's an animal that typically doesn't see the sun until it's being shipped off for slaughter. So it's an animal that, because it's being fed enormous amounts of antibiotics, is making antibiotics less effective for humans. You know, if we just pause and think, well, what are we celebrating when we celebrate Thanksgiving? Most people would say how lucky we are, you know, how grateful we feel to have food and to be able to gather as a family when there are so many people in the world who don't have those things. Mm-hmm. The more you know about the turkey, the less appropriate a symbol it feels.
And what will you be eating for Thanksgiving?
I will eat lots and lots and lots of things, actually. You know, we are like the classic long table Thanksgiving eaters with like 100 dishes, and everybody goes into a food coma afterward. So we just won't have turkey, that's all.
Awesome. Now, there's some movement to shift from eating factory farm meat to humanely raised meat. Do you think that it really solves the problem if everyone just switched from eating one kind of meat to another?
It doesn't solve the problem globally. I think it is a much, much better decision for individuals to make. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are somebody who is simply going to eat meat, period, you know, you're going to eat it, then the world is much better. If you eat from an independent farmer, the environmental effects are much, much less destructive. Sometimes they're not destructive at all. The cruelty to animals is greatly decreased, radically decreased, and the food tends to be much better for our bodies. But it can't be applied globally. There's just not enough space on the planet. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a little bit like, you know, can I imagine a situation in which it would be good to give a six-year-old a job, a paying job? I can, you know, where it might save that six-year-old's life or enable his family to stay together. But that doesn't make me an advocate of child welfare. Mm-hmm. Because when we're trying to make a system, a civilization, when we're trying to legislate, we don't think about the exceptions. We try to think about, you know, what the general picture will look like. You know, small family farms will always be the exception. So if someone, you know, says the only meat I eat is from those farms, I admire that person. But I guess I don't think it's the answer.
Jonathan, that's an interesting point that you make about our planet not being able to sustain everyone eating humanely raised meat. I'm curious what you think about in vitro meat.
I guess it would be great if they could make it safely. You know, I don't know if they can, but I certainly have no ethical problem with it. It's, you know, I can't even begin to imagine what the harm would be.
Right.
But, you know, whether or not they can actually make it, whether or not people would actually want to eat it, I just don't know.
Can you talk about the government subsidies that go into animal agriculture and the role it plays in the way we currently eat?
Well, we very heavily subsidize corn and soy for livestock. That's what most people mean when we're talking about subsidies. You know, corn and soy are foods that humans can eat, whereas grass isn't. Cows naturally eat grass and don't naturally eat corn or soy, so we've really got it all backward. But there are other kinds of subsidies going on. You know, when a place like McDonald's or Burger King, and these are the places that have, you know, dominated our food system, you know, pay their employees minimum wage or don't give them health care. You know, ultimately the government subsidizes these people through social services. When these farms don't clean up environmentally, somebody is paying for it and somebody will pay for it. There was a study done recently where an environmental group tried to quantify the environmental cost of a 50-cent hamburger, putting aside animal welfare and human health. And they found that the environmental cleanup for each 50-cent hamburger could be said to be responsible for is about $200. So, you know, this is you could call that a massive subsidy. So if the food cost what it actually costs, we would be eating far, far less than practically none at all.
That would be great if McDonald's start selling $200 hamburgers.
Right.
Now, in the U.S., you have USDA, and in Canada, we have CFIA, and these are giant government inspection agencies overseeing the standards of our food production. But it doesn't seem like they ever enforce any of their own regulations when it comes to animal agriculture. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts around these costly agencies and the purpose they serve.
Well, the problem with the USDA is that it's wearing two hats. On the one hand, it is tasked with endorsing industry. On the other hand, it is tasked with protecting consumers and animals. And those jobs in a world in which, or in a country in which 99% of animals are factory farmed, it's a conflict of interest.
Jonathan, in your book, you present a case for eating dogs, and you even give a recipe for stewed dog. Can you talk to us about this section of your book?
Well, I mean, I wasn't making the case sincerely so much as to point out that we often have some very unusual, irrational ideas about animals and why we treat different animals in such radically different ways. You know, if we examine them, it can be part, you know, just it can be part of this movement toward, you know, seeing if our actions when it comes to food are reflective of our values.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about fish, Jonathan? Oftentimes when people reduce their meat consumption, they cut out all animals except for fish, as if that's okay and acceptable and not a hugely detrimental thing to do. Why is it not okay?
It's not okay for a couple of reasons. I mean, I don't actually usually get into what's okay and what's not okay because, you know, different people care about different things. What I try to do with my book is to present a lot of information and some ways of thinking about the information that can help guide people toward actions that they're comfortable with. So when it comes to fish, you know, environmentally, our fishing industry is a nightmare. It's been estimated that in the year 2048, we won't have any wild fish left if we continue to fish as we have been fishing. You know, we know that we're dumping huge amount of antibiotics into the ocean. We're introducing genetically altered fish that are escaping into wild populations and contaminating them. So environmentally speaking, it's a pretty straightforward situation. In terms of animal welfare, you know, if the only thing to have improved in the last 50 years in farming is slaughter, and that, you know, the technology that's now brought to bear really probably does increase the chances of an animal dying painlessly. We know that fish don't die painlessly, and we also have very, very good reasons to think that they experience pain in a way that's probably similar to a lot of land animals. So, you know, in terms of animal welfare, it's a real, to some, it's a real concern.
Now, one of the most shocking thing I read in your book, and I'm just going to read a quote from it, is imagine being served a plate of sushi, but this plate also holds all of the animals that were killed for your serving of sushi. The plate might have to be 5 feet across. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, I was talking about what's called bycatch, and which basically is when they're fishermen are trying to catch a specific kind of fish, they end up catching other fish, and sometimes lots and lots and lots of other fish. You know, in the case of shrimp, sometimes the bycatch rate can be like 98%. 98% of what they catch is other sea life, which then just gets thrown back into the sea, you know, dead. Yes, in the book I talk about how, you know, sushi, if we were to close the distances, if we were to actually see all of these animals that we're killing for not to eat, not to use in any way, but simply because our fishing techniques make it unavoidable, and there are other fishing techniques. If we were to able to close that sort of conceptual gap and have the information in front of us, I think people would make different choices.
So you've previously said that the strongest positive reaction to your book has been from farmers. Is this from factory farmers, or are you talking about small-scale farmers? I'm curious.
No, definitely. I mean, factory farmers would have no reason to like my book.
Right.
No, small farmers. I mean, small farmers get a bad rap, a very bad rap. You know, it is true. There is simply no way around the fact that they raise animals to slaughter them for people to eat. But these are people who often treat their animals at least as well as, you know, I treat my dog, who give them the space that they want, the foods that they want, allow them to engage in their species-specific behaviors, and then kill them in a way is as painless as could possibly be expected. Now, it's not to say that it's at all perfect. There are huge problems with it, and, you know, I don't eat that kind of meat. But I do think that the small farmers I met were incredibly intelligent, respectful, sensitive, smart people whose sort of mission often aligns, actually, with that of an animal rights group. You know, the things that PETA is fighting for and the things that small farmers are working toward are often remarkably similar. So, yes, it's been nice since the book has come out to hear a very strong positive reaction from them.
And you've said that the strongest negative reaction has been from animal rights people for not going far enough. How do you respond to this criticism?
I don't disagree. I mean, I know what they're saying, that, you know, if something is wrong, it's wrong. There's just, how can you talk about incrementally improving something that is simply wrong? I do understand why they would say that, and I'm glad that there are people who are saying that. All I can say is it's not my strategy. You know, if I think if the goal is to reduce the amount of environmental destruction and to reduce the amount of animal suffering, we need different techniques happening at once.
That was our interview with Jonathan Safran-Foer.
Unfortunately, it cut off there because I had forgotten to turn on the recorder.
And you just got cut off a bit at the beginning there too. Yeah. Sorry, didn't know you were going to talk. Anyways, you've been listening to the Animal Voices show here on Co-op Radio at 102.7 FM. I just want to remind our listeners, we are starting our membership drive, our bi-yearly membership drive today, and that means we need your support. So if you do support the work that we do here on the show, and it is a lot of hard work, all volunteer that Joanne, Carissa, and I do, and Dan helping out as well. We do ask you to please go onto co-opradio.org to make a donation. It'll be much appreciated. Any amount helps, and that money helps keep the show on the air. Next week, we've got some exciting interviews coming up as we are talking about It's the Taste of Health Food Festival next week. So I have Teresa Tomek, who is the coordinator of this event. She's going to come on the air and do a short interview with us to let us know about everything that you can expect at this year's Taste of Health Vegetarian Food Festival in Vancouver, BC, Canada. That's next Saturday. And in the evening, as we had mentioned before, John Robbins, the founder of EarthSave, is going to be in Vancouver, and he's going to be on our show next week as well. So it's going to to be a great honor to have him here. He is the founder of Earth Save and the author of the international bestseller Diet for a New America. I've read of so many people going vegetarian as a result of reading this book, and we have him here on the show next week. And he also has a new book out now called The New Good Life, which I've been reading very fervently this week in preparation for the interview. Really good book. So that's it for this week, and right now we'll leave you with Cow Song by Will Tettle. Talk to you next week.